The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast Special Edition, May 17th, 2018. BuzzFeed News Today published what it called the definitive story of how Trump's team worked the Trump-Moscow deal during the campaign. It's an exhaustive account of the Trump Tower-Moscow deal that contains a number of important news developments. The team of Anthony Cormier and Jason Leopold got their hands on a large trove of text messages and emails between broker Felix Sater and Michael Cohen of the Trump Organization. Anthony Cormier joined me remotely this afternoon to discuss the story, what it means, and whether we can still say there's no collusion. I want to start at the end of your story, which is a long and detailed story that ends with what I think is a pretty shocking piece of news, which is that the negotiations over Trump Tower did not end in January, Trump Tower Moscow, that is, did not end in January of 2016, but continued at least into May of that year, with Michael Cohen as late as May negotiating a possible Trump-Putin meeting in Moscow after the Republican convention.
Right, that's true. And I'll add a little bit of new news that we just found out momentarily ago. Our understanding is that the negotiations continued actually into some point in July. I'm told by Felix Sater that they were using an encrypted app called Dust to continue the negotiations all the way into July. Our sort of on-the-record reporting, the documented reporting, says that at least until about June 14th, which is a bit before the convention, they have a conversation where it appears, at least according to the text messages, that Michael has agreed to attend the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, conference in Russia. And from our sort of view, he's very eager to head over there. And Felix Sater essentially is telling us that he calls him four times on June the 14th, I believe it is, or texts him four times on the 14th and says, look, I'm going to the consulate today. We have these plans. Let's go pick up our visas, solidify this, and head over. Of course, that's a remarkably sort of deep period for them to be negotiating in, certainly far longer than Michael has acknowledged. And it suggests to us that they were really quite serious, that not only was Mr. Cohen going to go, but so was Trump.
Okay, so let me boil this down. In the period after Trump has secured the nomination to be the Republican presidential nominee, he is still negotiating, or his organization in the person of Michael Cohen is still negotiating building Trump Tower Moscow, and it is still negotiating a Trump-Putin meeting to finalize that deal that would take place, according to these text exchanges that you guys published, after the Republican presidential nominating convention. Do you have any indication as to whether Donald Trump knew that these negotiations were taking place? And when does the evidence of Trump's personal knowledge of it end?
Our understanding is that Michael Cohen briefed President Trump at least three times, although we are absolutely unclear on when those occasions occurred, right? So Michael has said both publicly and to us, yes, indeed, I did tell him that we were sort of moving along in these negotiations, except that we don't know when the last moment that Michael Cohen briefed him. In fact, Sater doesn't know either, and he's actually asked. Although not to obfuscate, but to sort of add a little bit to that point, it is very clear to Sater anyway that Michael isn't acting on his own. At least in the conversation that they had on June 14th in Trump Tower, it was indicated to him that Michael had some level of buy-in beyond himself to go ahead and negotiate this trip over there, except we at this point don't have anything on the record. Some of that is due to their use of this encrypted app. Some of it is due to the fact that Michael simply won't tell us.
All right, so the second piece of, I think, quite shocking news in this story, and I'm gonna ask you momentarily for an overview of the story, but I want to start by kind of pulling out these two pieces of that just strike me as incredible news. The other one is that the Trump Organization, among their Russian interlocutors in negotiating this deal, was a former GRU, that's Russian military intelligence operative, whom they knew to be a spy.
This is true. Well, we're not clear whether or not the Trump Organization knew that this individual was a former member of the GRU. We reported, I assume it was about a month ago, that the presence of this individual in the negotiations. And now we're able to sort of at least see records that suggest that Michael was talking to this individual. So I've got no indication that Sater told them who he was, but I do have reporting that says there is no doubt that Michael at least was on the phone with this individual.
And who, and just to be clear, Sater knew he was a spy or knew he was a former Russian spy.
Absolutely did. He's not just a spy. He's a friend of Felix's. And their relationship dates back at least to the mid-1990s, where Felix, as you recall, is sort of a felon on the run. He's escaped to the Soviet Union because he's facing an indictment on a $40 million stock fraud scheme. He's over there working with Mirax, a Russian development company. He hooks up with a sometime operator for the DIA and essentially becomes this asset for the U.S. government, which is in and of itself a remarkable story. But as part of that, he's introduced to an individual who at the time was a colonel in the GRU. And this colonel helped Felix obtain some fairly remarkable pieces of evidence that he then relayed back to sort of his American handlers, right? In 1998, he helps Felix acquire, actually hands to Felix, five satellite telephone numbers that belong to Osama bin Laden. Later in the decade, actually in the early aughts, he gives to Sater photographs of a North Korean military official who is sort of attempting to purchase precursor materials for nuclear weapons on the black market. This allows our intelligence community to track this individual down. So this individual, as you can imagine, while he is a GRU official, and Felix has acknowledged to us and to the Senate that there are no such things as former Russian spies, it's very clear to us that this is an individual who's playing both sides. He later becomes an arms trafficker. He remains close to Felix, and it's our understanding this individual, this former GRU spy, has deep connections to VTB Bank, and he is the sort of linchpin to the financing of Trump Tower. He is the guy who is essentially asserting to Felix and through Felix to Michael, I can get VTB on board. Don't worry about it. Let me take care of your visa applications. You come on over. I'll introduce you to VTB's chairman. We've got this all taken care of. He becomes the sort of axis on which this entire financing aspect rests. And it is a sort of very remarkable thing. I can't quite wrap my head around it, particularly because the American intelligence community believes that the GRU was responsible for the interference, or at least the hacking part of the interference in last year's election. And so to see him pop up in this role is quite shocking. I haven't been able to wrap my meager brain around what it means yet.
Right. So for those listeners who don't remember, when you hear the term cozy bear as opposed to fancy bear, that is a reference to GRU, right? So now talk to me about Felix Sater's relationship to the Trump Organization, because we have this GRU former who Sater says, well, you're never a former spy for the Russians, interfacing occasionally directly with Michael Cohen, but principally he is somebody who is brought into the conversation by Felix Sater. Who is Sater working for in this interaction? He's some kind of a broker between the Trump Organization and various Russian actors, but who is he for purposes of this transaction?
I will be as blunt as I can possibly be. Felix Sater was working for himself. As far as I can, I've spent a great deal of time with the man, perhaps too much time that I care to acknowledge. He is 100%, to at least my mind, simply trying to get paid. He sees an opportunity, and Felix, like many, many deal makers, sort of jumps in with both feet, tries to capitalize on the moment, and to be fair, tries to make $100 million for himself. And so what he does is he...
As one does.
I mean, if you've got former GRU spies in your Rolodex, why not? So Felix, I mean, I'll take a step back and explain perhaps to folks who are not that familiar with who he is. I mean, he's sort of been the boogeyman through a lot of this investigation. But it's important to give the correct context. So Felix Sater is, you know, he and his family come to the United States when he's six. Don't think it's a stretch to say that Felix's father, after some sort of personal setbacks in the United States, gets involved with some levels of sort of street crime, you know, maybe perhaps gambling. A lot of people say he's definitely involved with organized crime. I don't have reporting that supports that. He's definitely in the mix. I don't think Felix would object to that characterization. You know, Felix grows up kind of on the roughneck side of Brooklyn and Brighton Beach, which, as we know, is a Russian enclave. He's quite brilliant, has a great mind for financial markets, goes to Bear Stearns, goes to Lehman. He's kind of a whiz kid, gets into a fight, as has been widely reported, and you know, gets in a quite bad brawl at a bar, goes to prison, loses his broker's license, so he's got to find a way to make money. And the way that Felix made money was to essentially rip people off. So to the tune of $40 million, he escapes back to Russia, where he gets involved with a number of various and sundry characters, and eventually winds up trying to work off his sentence with the FBI, the CIA, and the Defense Intelligence Agency. This continues for a period of years, as we've reported in the past. A great number of FBI officials, including Loretta Lynch herself, have called his cooperation unprecedented. We've confirmed that as many as 8 officials. He lives sort of like an outlaw, right? He's got a foot in both worlds. He comes back to the United States with a company called Bayrock, which is a sort of financial firm, a development company that eventually hooks up with the Trump Organization. And in the early 2000s, Felix actually occupies an office on the 26th floor in Trump Tower, which later is occupied by Michael Cohen. And eventually, he is a guy that brings Donald Trump deals. So you can see him working his magic all across the globe. And the most famous example is perhaps Trump Soho. And so he has a very direct relationship with the president. And at some point, though, his sort of background catches up to him. He doesn't really declare who he is to bankers. Bankers then become worried. He can no longer be associated with Trump. He can no longer be associated with Bayrock. He takes a sort of step back and lives in the shadows. You could sort of fast forward to the mid-2000s, where he's still working for the Trump Organization, and his sort of old friend, Michael Cohen. These are two folks who hung out in Brooklyn, and in Felix Sater's words, they liked to date the good girls from Queens. And so they, you know, these two guys are good friends. They're in the mid-2000s. They're working deals. Felix has to take a step back. And when he does, Michael ascends. Michael Cohen becomes the go-to guy, the sort of fixer character that we all know him to be now. And so when the president begins his improbable run to the White House, Felix gets a brilliant idea and says, let's do it. Let's capitalize on the success. In his words, it's essentially Russians didn't place a whole lot of cachet in Trump. He didn't carry a whole lot of weight overseas. They weren't willing to pay a premium for a Trump name on their building. But as he began to say nice things about Russia, began to flatter President Putin, Felix saw that as an opportunity to take advantage. And so Felix returns to his old buddy Michael Cohen and says, let's get this tower built. They begin with the letter of intent, and then the hard part begins. They've got to obtain financing. And that's where, once he begins to work his magic, his connections, that's where you see this intersection with not only the former GRU spy, but a number of billionaires and oligarch types and sort of very close Putin associates. And that's, I think, where this story begins to get a little murky.
All right. So we have the Russians, and the Russians here are government spies, former spies, and bankers and oligarchs.
Yes.
We have this intermediary, Felix Sater, who's kind of a freelance deal maker, who's worked with or/for the Trump organization before, but is kind of working on his own now, but only really gets paid if he brings them a deal.
Yep.
And we've got Michael Cohen, who's the actual functionary on behalf of the Trump organization. Broadly speaking, those are the three parties that are in discussions here. Is that fair?
Correct. I think what's really interesting about Michael's role in this is he wasn't getting points. He wasn't going to take money out. He wasn't going to get paid anything extra. Felix would have gotten rich. The Trump organization would have gotten rich. Michael, as far as we can tell, was doing it only to impress his boss, only to rise in his boss's eyes.
Right. And you have amazing correspondence between the two of them where, you know, Cohen basically has a temper tantrum.
Oh, it's a pretty classic Michael Cohen meltdown.
Over the possibility of losing face with his boss. What do you look at? I mean, one of the things I was struck by in these exchanges is that the Russians seem principally interested in having Donald Trump come to Russia. That seems like at every stage, that seems like what the Russian parties to the conversation are interested in have happen. The Trump organization side is really interested in a clear financial commitment to support the deal. Is that a fair summary?
I think that's absolutely spot on. It's very clear. I mean, at least as far as we can tell through these documents, these records, Michael is trying to impress his boss and finish a deal. But on the other side of the ledger, on the sort of oligarch billionaire side, it appears to us that they were willing to at least consider the financing, at least entertain the notion, as long as they could get first Michael and second Trump to visit. And you'll see in all of the letters, all of their communications, there's quite a bit less about here are the terms, here's the potential location. Most of their push is, we really, really want you to come, whether that's this weird sort of obscure boxing promoter who says, based on our conversations, we'd really like to get you over here soon. Whether it's this former GRU spy who really kind of pushes quite hard, which I think is kind of interesting, pushes really hard to get Michael Cohen's passport photos, which Michael Cohen sends through Felix Sater, including the front page with all of his identifying information. And I sort of shocked to see that. And they're regularly getting on the phone, either personally with Michael or through Felix, and pressing. This is a day after day after day event. And it goes from, you see it from not only the bankers, not only the GRU spy, but sort of these obscure figures. And finally, an institution called Rus Congress, which is essentially an economic outfit that supports the St. Peter's Economic Forum, St. Peter's Economic Forum. And Rus Congress at one point in the negotiations is so eager to have them come over that they send what's known as a support letter to both Mr. Sater and Mr. Cohen that they are to bring to the consulate the next day. It's a way, our understanding is it's a way for an American citizen to expedite the visa process. They would have been able to walk in with this letter and walk out the door with their correct travel paperwork, where it would have taken a normal citizen like you or I significantly longer to do so. And so we see the Russian interests pushing quite hard on the very notion of just get them over here, get them over here, bring them. We want to do this.
So I want to connect this to the other approaches that the Russians allegedly made to people in Trump world. George Papadopoulos, Carter Page, are both trying to arrange a Trump-Putin meeting. And when you look closely, as you guys have now done, at the Trump Tower Moscow deal, it looks like a big part of the Russian strategic objective in that too was to arrange a Trump-Putin meeting. Which is ironic, of course, because in 2013 at the Miss Universe pageant, it was Trump who is desperate to get a meeting with Putin, right?
Absolutely.
Here, I look at all of these approaches to Trump world, and it seems like what the Russians really want is a meeting between the two.
They want face-to-face time with the man himself. I find quite interesting this idea that a very powerful government official, Dmitry Peskov, who is essentially, we would consider him to be the sort of the spokesperson, the press secretary for the Kremlin. If you recall, sometime in January, late January, Michael Cohen, after the deal, after he's sort of blown up at Felix and the deal looks like it's on the rocks, Michael Cohen takes this unusual gambit and he writes a letter, an email to a sort of general press inquiry email account controlled by the Kremlin, wherein he asks Mr. Peskov for a meeting. He essentially says, I need your help. I respectfully request someone, preferably you, contact me. Well, that has been long ago reported, I think, by either the Washington Post or the New York Times, who've been, of course, doing brilliant work on this matter. But then Mr. Peskov disappears from the thing until now. Now we understand that Peskov reemerges. He reemerges, I think it's in, forgive me for getting the date wrong, I think sometime in May, where Felix is saying, hey, that guy Peskov, he wants to talk to you. He really wants to talk to you. In fact, he wants to talk to you so bad and Mr. Trump so bad that he wants you to come over and he wants to personally introduce you to either Medvedev or Putin himself. So it's a really remarkable sort of turn of events, I think. And I don't fully understand Peskov's role in it, but I do find it to be sort of more than coincidental that Michael reaches out to him, and many months later, as this thing heats up, as Trump approaches the nomination, that Peskov sort of emerges as a big player in this.
I mean, this is right around the same time, within a month or so of the Trump Tower meeting in New York, Trump Tower.
Absolutely. It's almost, I mean, it tracks right with it. And I think if you look at some of the other events, not to take my tinfoil hat and put it on for a second, there are other moments where, you know, I think there's a moment in December where Felix and Michael are talking and then Flynn appears at the Russia Today banquet. I think if you could sort of put this on a timeline and without making too many assumptions, I think you can look at it and say there is a very concerted effort for whatever reasons to get Trump, get his surrogates overseas and in a room with top Russian officials. I think it's a disputable at this point.
And this takes place right around the same time as Veselnitskaya shows up in New York with a promise that she's going to deliver dirt as part of the Russian government's support for Trump. And then that is in turn, though the meeting itself does not involve that, that is in turn relatively shortly precedes the initial release of information. So when you zoom way out and you look at it from sort of 40,000 feet, what is the meaning and significance of the Trump Tower Moscow negotiation from beginning to end?
Right. The most important thing I'm taking away, I hope readers will take away, is that it is very clear that very influential, very powerful Russian individuals, many of whom are very close to the Kremlin itself, were beyond eager. They were sort of salivating at the opportunity to have both a Trump surrogate and Trump himself visit them in person. That these were not normal steps, that they were, it feels like they pulled out all of the stops. They pulled the big guns out and perhaps used Sater as a way to get close to them, used Sater and the Trump organization's thirst for a deal to get within proximity of these individuals. And while we have no indication at this point that anybody went anywhere, and Michaels denied this, I don't think you can dismiss the fact that they went all in on attempting to get a face-to-face between Trump and Putin. We don't know the reason why, and we can only speculate. I think to my mind, that's the biggest takeaway. It's their desire, particularly as he solidified himself as a candidate. You know, there's one thing when he's leading the polls early on, but as they're moving towards, as he essentially wraps it up on paper, they begin to push hard. That's when you begin to see these letters. You begin to see these sort of obscure characters reach out. Our understanding is that there are, you know, that one of these individuals said that he had a conversation with Mike. I think that's, to my mind, that's what I'm walking away with, is there's a reason that Russia wanted them to come over. We don't know what that is. We could speculate, but I'm not in the business of speculating at this point.
How much of this information does Bob Mueller have?
All of it. It's part of a package that's turned over, I believe, in mid-December to the Office of Special Counsel, and then subsequently to both the intelligence committees in the House and the Senate.
Anthony Cormier, congratulations on this. This is an amazing piece of work that I really recommend to people. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, man. Talk to you soon.
This has been a special edition of the Lawfare podcast, which is, of course, produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks to Anthony Cormier for joining me on such short notice. You should do your part to promote, tweet, Facebook share, like, all those things, the Lawfare podcast, and you should also rate us on iTunes, on Stitcher, and whatever podcast distribution services you use. Our music, but not today, because a special edition of the Lawfare podcast doesn't have music, but if it did have music, it would be being performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com